In the past few days, we have been treated, and I put it that way purposefully, treated to the funeral of an ex-president. And one of the things that funerals does is bring families together. And it was very interesting and hopeful, I think, that the family of this ex-president was brought together, and we got to see some of his family up close and personal. We also got to see and hear about some of his background, and in the background on the television was his boyhood home, as was repeated so many times, built by his father. This is where this ex-president grew up, and as one of the men who gave a eulogy said, "How American." Well, I think that's true. Here was a man who came from very humble means and rose to a preeminent position of power, and literally, I think it can be said, shaped his world. Many of us were struck by his family. Not because his family is in the news a lot now, or because his family is scandal-ridden, but because that family appears, at least, to be a stable family in our culture and in our society. And I was really amazed at how many commented on this. It's interesting to me that we tend to measure the Bible by such standards. Isn't that interesting? I'm reminded of a meeting of presbytery where we were examining a young man, and there was some debate about the length of days in the creation narrative, and some were vying for these days being 24-hour days, and others were vying for these days being very long, millions of years. And the poor fellow that was being examined was caught in a crossfire. And I remember very well one of the men in presbytery standing up and saying, "I don't see how anybody could go to a place like the Grand Canyon and see that canyon and see how the water has cut out that canyon and see the strata in that canyon and not believe in days that are thousands of years long or perhaps millions of years long in Genesis." And I scratched my head. I didn't say anything out loud. I did say some things afterwards. I scratched my head and said, "You know, that's strange. I thought we were supposed to interpret the Grand Canyon by the Bible, not interpret the Bible by the Grand Canyon." Seems to me that that's the case anyway. Now, I know not everyone agrees with me on that, but I think that's how it should be. And we tend, it seems to me, to look at families in our world and then judge the Bible by those families. What we want to do this morning is look at a family in the Bible. And I'm asking the question, what is a normal family? My father-in-law used to always ask, what is normal? And that's a good question, too. And perhaps as we look at Ruth, the beginning of Ruth, we can get something in the way of an answer to this question. Again, Ruth chapter 1. "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. And she was left with her two sons. And they took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. I submit to you this morning that Elimelech's family is a rather typical family, and a rather typical family in Israel. Elimelech was not a king. Elimelech was not one of the judges that we read about in the book of Judges. Elimelech was not a famous elder of the people of Israel. He wasn't a prophet or a priest. And interestingly enough, there is no genealogy given for Elimelech. If you turn to the end of the book of Ruth in chapter 4, there is a genealogy which is given. In chapter 4 and verse 18, it says, "Now these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nahshon, and to Nahshon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David." Now we have the genealogy of David, the king. We do not have the genealogy of Elimelech. He wasn't one of those high-powered people. Very interesting that this should be the case. Even though the family line was very important to all of the Jewish people, the fact that this genealogy of Elimelech is not given is an indication that this guy is not a high-powered guy. This is not a high-powered family. And when it comes right down to it, not many families are ranking families in a society. Here is a common person. And if he lived in our day, he might be your mailman. He might be your trash collector. He might be the city worker or the store clerk. And so I think this story of Elimelech and his family, with which the book of Ruth begins, is your story. It's a story about you, as it's a story about him. There was a man. There was a husband. And he had two sons. It's not a big family. It's interesting, isn't it, that when we think of families in those days, we think of big families. In our congregation, we have the privilege of having large families and we have small families. That's great. It's the way it ought to be. Even the larger families in our congregation are huge compared to biblical times. I was reading in 2 Chronicles the other night, and I hadn't remembered this. I know I've read it before, but I didn't remember it, that Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, had 80 children. He had 60 daughters and 20, or 88 children. He had 60 daughters and 28 sons. That's a family. So, you know, you go from one extreme to the other here, don't you? And this is not a big family. It's not a famous family. And the names of these individuals tell us something about them. Elimelech, the name Elimelech, means God is my king, or my God is king. I think that latter translation is probably the best. My God is king. And the name Naomi means my delight. And you can just see this family of this man taking this woman as his wife, and embracing her and saying, "She is indeed my delight." You know, what a wonderful thing that is. And of course, this lady was given this name by her father. And her father looked at her and said, "My delight." We did the same thing when Gail was born, our oldest daughter. The name Gail is a shortened form of the name Abigail, which means the joy of her father. And certainly she is. So those names tell us something. And then there's the name of the elder son, Malan. You know what that name means? Sick. And he was probably given that name because when he was born, he was a sickly young man. He wasn't strong. And the parents gave him that name. And the name of the other son, Chilion, means pining or grieving or mourning or lamenting. There was sadness. And during that time, when these children were born, the nation of Israel was under the cruel hand of the Midianites. It's very probable that David's grandfather was a contemporary of Gideon. And when we get this story of Elimelech, we're in the time of the judges, as it is said, and it's very likely that the Midianites are in control. Elimelech's family, therefore, was not an unusual family, as most families are not unusual. And Elimelech's family had its trials and griefs and difficulties and challenges. Elimelech's family was not a wealthy family. If you look at Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1 once again, "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons." Here was a family that was wiped out by famine. Did they have their financial difficulties? Absolutely. Their farmstead was wiped out, like many of the farms last year were wiped out by the flood in Middle America. And they lost everything. They retained that piece of property for a time, as we see in the scriptures, but they lost everything. And later, Naomi was forced to sell the property. It says in chapter 4 and in verse 4 or verse 3, "Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech." We know about things like this. This was a bankruptcy situation. And they faced it. You know, folks, bankruptcy is not unbiblical. For those who just don't have the resources to pay. We've got this thing in our American culture that people who have to file for bankruptcy are some kind of unclean people or something. That's just not true. You know what happened in the nation of Israel? Every 7 years, the law required that debts were to be forgiven. That's how it was to work. Now, the people didn't follow those regulations the way they should because they were too selfish. And at the year of Jubilee, all the land that was sold during the previous 50 years was to revert back to the original family. So the family always had a place to live. And all of that was a reflection of the mercy of God. You know what I think? I think if we are so hard on people that we say to them, "Your debts have to be paid no matter what," we have no mercy. And we don't have the mercy that God has on his people. This family was faced with that kind of situation. And this family was forced to move and forsake its possessions. How many families in our economy today have to move to another location? A child of this congregation is faced with that very prospect. At this moment, He doesn't want to move his family, but it could be that he will have to move his family for economic reasons. That's exactly what happened here. And they were forced to move because of the famine. And they became travelers and sojourners in the land of Moab. They didn't intend to stay there. It says in chapter 1 and in verse 4, they lived there about 10 years. They went to find a better place for a time. And it was their intention, it seems to me, to return to the land of Judah and to their homeland. In addition, this family was a grief-stricken family. Verse 3 says, "Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons." What a tough time that must have been. Gone to a foreign land, shortly after they're there, the husband dies. And here this mother is left with her two sons. But there's consolation. The next verse says to us, "And they took for themselves Moabite women as wives, and the name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth, and they lived there about 10 years. Covering some of the grief was a time of celebration as the family enjoyed these weddings. Interestingly enough, the law of God did not specifically forbid Israelites to marry Moabite women. It specifically forbid the marriage of individuals within the land, Canaanites particularly. But it was a different story here. And the Bible says that the Moabites, because of their refusal to help the children of Israel when they entered the promised land, were not allowed for 10 generations to be incorporated into the people of God. And so there was a different status present among those people. It could be for this reason Elimelech and his family went into the land of Moab. At any rate, there is the loss of the father. And then verse 5 says, "Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died." I tried to work this text over the best that I could in both the Greek language and the Hebrew language. And the best that I can tell, although I couldn't find it verified in any of the commentaries, I still think it's the case that both of these sons died together. They both died almost at the same time. You can imagine what that would do to a family. And so, this family suffered many trials and difficulties and challenges and had much grief. In chapter 1 and verse 20, when Naomi comes back to Bethlehem, she says, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? Call me Mara, because my heart aches at what has taken place. We went out to this land, and our desire was simply to find something better for ourselves. And we didn't find it." Elimelech's family, it appears to me, was also a godly family. It was not only a typical kind of family, a family that had its trials and griefs, but at root, it seems to me, it was a godly family. And I don't say that Elimelech and his wife Naomi and his children were deeply religious and pious. In fact, I don't think that was the case at all. And I don't say that they were 100% obedient, because I don't think that was the case either. I don't say that they were very scrupulous in their following the Word of God. They went to Moab. They forsook their homeland and went to this foreign land. And although, as I mentioned, the marriage with Moabite women was not strictly forbidden, it was not the best circumstance for the family. But there are other considerations. Think about the fact that this family must have engaged in the training of its children. I think this had to be the case. And I say this is the case because in the end, Ruth turns to Naomi and Ruth says to Naomi, "Your people are my people, and your God is my God, and I'm going to have it that way." And I don't think that would have come about at all unless this family had engaged in the training of its sons, and unless this family had engaged in training its daughters-in-law. Now, it's true that one of these young women went back to Moab. She didn't take to the training. That happens in families, doesn't it? That's one reason we need to pray for our children. We need to pray mightily for our children. The name Orpah means gazelle. It means she flies back home. And the name Ruth is interpreted to mean friend. A real friend. And that's what it turned out to be. And so Ruth wants to go back to Israel. And when Naomi and Ruth go back to Judah, what do? They work under the guidance of the Scriptures for the restoration of the family. And it's very interesting because these people understood, it seems to me, the providence of God. What is the providence of God? Didn't I hear that defined earlier? The providence of God being is governing and preserving all of his creatures and all of their actions. They believed that. And they believed in God's working with his people. And that's why when Naomi comes back to the land, she says, "Why do you call me Naomi? Call me Mara." Because of the way the Almighty has dealt with me. They understood the greatness of God. And they were willing to work under that greatness of the Almighty. And when Ruth went gleaning, Naomi realized that that wasn't just a happenstance. When Ruth wound up in the field of Boaz, who was a relative of the family, Naomi realized, this is the hand of God. And so I say to you that this family, albeit a very typical family with its difficulties and challenges, was yet a godly family and found the solution to many of its difficulties in God Himself. Is this a normal family? Well, I guess you have to make a judgment on that. How about comparing some of the things that are happening in the 20th century with Elimelech's family. Families today have the same struggles, griefs, difficulties. And so families today are not much different in this regard. American families, however, may be more religious than Elimelech's family was, but I say to you, they were not as godly as Elimelech's family was. They were less godly. Few people today in our culture and in our society have a sense of the providence of God as this family did. Few families understand the workings of God as this family did. Today in our society, we are rife with the thought that there are no moral absolutes. In our bulletin this morning, I'm glad for what Harry put in here. There are no moral absolutes. That is, about 66% of Americans believe there is no such thing as absolute truth. Among young adults between 18 and 25, the percentage is even higher. 72% of people between 18 and 25 believe there are no moral absolutes. That is awful. And that's one reason why the training of families is so important. And the training that went on in Elimelech's family was so important. Today we're in a situation where there are working parents and latchkey children, and the television is the babysitter and the purveyor of moral values. Fewer families eat together. I am absolutely amazed at the fact that families, Christian families, that don't eat together, that the children are forced to go to the cupboard when they come home from school and fend for themselves, and the family doesn't sit around the table together. What a missed opportunity this is. We live in a society where there is massive hedonism. Pleasure is the end of life. We live in a nihilistic society, a society which says the traditional values with which we were brought up, most of us, are nothing, and we're setting them aside. God is a strange word in the vocabulary of many, except used as profanity. I submit to you that that's not normal. That is not normal. And that when we look at the family of Elimelech, we come closer to what a normal family might be. I want to talk about this some more next week. And I want to suggest some solutions. And I hope that as we come together, we will be looking at our own families and the opportunities we have to provide in our society the real solution to what's happening in the disintegration of families and our culture. I just want to challenge you with that, because it is so very important.